From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet a Hollywood legend, Lauren Bacall. We'll talk about her movies and marriage to her first leading man, Humphrey Bogart. In the new book, Now, she writes about her life as an older single woman. Also today, a retrospective of one of the great rock bands of the 60s and 70s. We talk with songwriter and guitarist Robbie Robertson about his years with the band. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Texas authorities now say 7 people have died in flash flooding in the southeastern part of the state. Heavy rains have inundated Houston. Some parts of Texas have received up to 20 inches in the last 36 hours. Texas Governor Ann Richards has declared 17 counties disaster areas. Damage estimates aren't yet known, but losses are believed to be in the millions of dollars. More than 10,000 people have been evacuated from counties north of Houston. More evacuations are expected today because of the swollen Trinity and San Jacinto rivers northeast of town. City schools and local courts have shut down. The Pentagon says it's dispatching counselors to Haiti in the wake of a third suicide by an American soldier taking part in the Haiti operation. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
An Army private is the latest victim, the third since the Haiti operation began. Pentagon spokesman Dennis Bach says the military is still investigating all 3 suicides.
We are, at this point, unable to determine whether there's a correlation between any of these 3, but we also cannot rule out a possible correlation.
2 of the soldiers were part of the Army's 10th Mountain Division. The Pentagon has sent a team of psychiatrists to Haiti to advise local commanders. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has called up another 3,100 reserves, primarily to relieve other soldiers of duties both in the U.S. and on the island nation. The military expects to get down to a force of about 15,500 by the end of the month. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Israel Radio says the Israeli parliament will ratify a peace treaty with Jordan 2 days before it's formally signed. The ceremony is planned for October 26. The accord mandates that Israel will supply water to Jordan and return some land that was seized nearly 50 years ago. The vice president and members of industry say they're satisfied with the progress toward more fuel-efficient cars. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
12 months into a 10-year government and industry partnership to develop a new generation of highly fuel-efficient cars, both sides say they're doing well. Vice President Al Gore saying they've developed a detailed plan for researching a variety of new technologies,
including lightweight materials from the space program and fuel cells, flywheels, and other devices previously used in space vehicles and advanced military technology.
Gore says the project is important for reducing pollution from automobile exhaust, as well as maintaining auto industry jobs. Bill Small at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 4 points to 3,919. Trading is heavy. The NASDAQ Composite Index has fallen almost a point to 764. This is NPR. The founder of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue says he will not go to jail without a fight. The U.S. Supreme Court has cleared the way for Randall Terry to serve a 5-month prison term. This stems from a contempt of court violation that occurred during the 1992 Democratic National Convention. One of Terry's colleagues disobeyed an injunction and thrust a bottled fetus at presidential candidate Bill Clinton. Terry has been free pending appeals. Now that the Supreme Court has ruled, New York prosecutors hope to arrange a surrender soon. A survey by the Gallup organization finds Americans are giving less of their money and time to charitable organizations. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The survey found that nearly three-quarters of American households gave money to charities last year, but people are giving less than they did in the past. The group Independent Sector, a coalition of volunteer organizations, speculates that the reason for the drop may be people's insecurity about their jobs and finances, despite signs that the economy continues to improve. IRS rules may also be affecting giving. People who file short forms can't deduct for charitable donations, and the survey found that people who itemized do tend to give more. The survey finds people are also giving less of their time. The number of Americans doing volunteer work for charities is down 3% compared to 4 years ago. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
A life insurance firm has released its annual list of the healthiest states to live in. New Hampshire comes in first, while Louisiana finishes last. Northwest National Life Insurance compiles its list based on a survey of 17 measures, including disease, lifestyle, and death rates. New Hampshire has a good environment, low crime, and its premature death rate is low. Louisiana's bottom ranking is blamed on a low high school graduation rate and a high number of traffic deaths. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
Everyone was knocked out by the 19-year-old Lauren Bacall when she made her screen debut in the 1944 film To Have and Have Not. 1 year later, she married her leading man, Humphrey Bogart. They were married for more than 11 years when Bogart died of cancer. Their screen lives together included the films The Big Sleep, Dark Passage, and Key Largo. Bacall also starred in other films such as Young Man with a Horn, How to Marry a Millionaire, Designing Woman, The Shootist, and Misery. Her latest is Robert Altman's new satire of the fashion world, Prêt-à-Porter, scheduled to open this Christmas. Bacall wrote about her life in her 1978 autobiography, By Myself, which won a National Book Award. In her new book, called Now, she reflects on her life now as an older, single woman. She told me that when Howard Hawks cast her into Have and Have Not, he wanted to make her into his version of the ideal woman.
Well, that ideal was a woman who was could give as good as she got, who had humor, who was kind of a woman of the world and somewhat insolent, and actually who behaved rather like a man.
What did that mean, to behave rather like a man?
Well, that you would look, you know, if a man said something to you, you would look at him directly. And he didn't like shy wallflower types, and always with humor, though, and always somewhat suggestive that something was in the offing, something could happen. And you weren't quite sure what that something was, but you knew that it would be fun and fascinating and probably different, unusual. I mean, he had this incredible thing going on in his brain, and it worked. Because I was insolent, and he wanted someone as... He always said he wanted someone as insolent as Bogart.
In your first autobiography, and By Myself, you
in
wrote...
In the only autobiography.
Well, this is a memoir. Okay, yes. Well, anyways, in that book you write that growing up you thought of yourself as a, quote, nice Jewish girl.
Mm-hmm.
So was there any conflict going on when you got into movies between that, quote, nice Jewish girl that you felt you were brought up to be... and this kind of insolent, assertive, sexual woman who you were playing on screen?
No, because I love that. I mean, once you're a nice Jewish girl, you're always a nice Jewish girl, you know. That basic thing never changes, I'm afraid. You never lose that. But no, I didn't think that. I loved doing that. To have an opportunity to be like that, a woman of the world, and insolent, having had adventures. Oh, God, so glamorous. Fabulous.
What did you do early on to convey the sense of mystery that your character had to have?
I don't think I did anything.
And I'm thinking of To Have and Have Not and The
yes.
Big Sleep.
But I don't think I did anything. I think it just happened. I think it was there. You know, there are certain things in one's personality that you're not even aware that you have. There are things that a camera picks up that you don't really know about.
Mm-hmm.
And they convey a certain aspect of your personality that leads you to believe all these things that you want to believe. You know, you can read, an audience reads things into a character and a personality that they really want to read. into that person.
You had something that was described as the look. I mean, your eyes were kind of droopy, and you'd look at people with your head lowered a little bit. And
yes, and I'd look up at them.
Yeah. So describe the look a little bit
chin
more
on chest.
And how you got it.
Well, I was terribly nervous during Tab and Avenatte. It was quite a terrifying experience for me, and I was this kid, and I was scared to death of all these pros around me, and really had almost no experience on the stage, and certainly none in film. So I was shook when Hawk said action, and there was quiet on the set. I'd start to walk into a scene, and then my head would shake, and my hands would shake. And I discovered that if I kept my head down and looked up, my head would not shake. So I started to do that when I could, when it was appropriate in a scene. And that's how the look came about. But it wasn't that I had planned to have a look. It was just that it was a way to keep my head steady. And that was very important. Terrible to look at another actor while your head is shaking.
What did Humphrey Bogart, who became your husband, teach you about acting when you were starting out?
Well, the one thing that he taught me, the major thing that he taught me, was to think before the scene started. To realize that you came from somewhere, that something happened before you entered a scene. So that when Howard Hawks said action, your character did not begin with the word action. Your character began before then. So that you came on stage, on screen, into the scene with an attitude, with a point of view, with some weight behind you, instead of aimlessly entering the scene and speaking words. And that was a very valuable thing that he taught me.
I think a lot of people have been a little disappointed by life and by love because they compare it to what they've seen in the movies and it never quite measures up to the movie version. Before you ever really experienced love, you were acting out the movie version of romance. And then you started having the romance with the person who you were acting it out with on screen. And I guess I'm really wondering if there was anything disappointing about the real life version of it, even though it was the same two people who were doing it on screen.
The early romance was the most romantic experience I have ever had in my life, far surpassing anything that I might have dreamed of or imagined. It was quite amazing. I mean, when you are young and when it's your first love and you are just carried away by it and when that's all you can think about. And you see, Bogey was the kind of man who believed in taking care of a marriage and taking care of a relationship. He believed you had to work at it and keep it fresh and fun and interesting, and he did.
He was already a movie star to you, right?
Oh, yes,
when you worked
absolutely.
Together. So you had a sense of him as an icon as well as
no,
a man.
No, not as an icon. He was not my favorite movie star.
Mm-hmm. Did you tell him that?
Yes, he knew it. No, Leslie Howard was my favorite. Uh-huh. He knew that. But he had worked with Leslie Howard in Petrified Forest, which is funny, you know. No, he wasn't an icon when I met him. I mean, he would, because it was after Casablanca, and he was a big star, but certainly not what he is today, which is this legend, this incredible icon now. I mean, he is bigger than ever.
I'm sure you've been asked this a zillion times, but do you think that what you and Bogart were feeling off screen, you can see on screen? I mean, that the real relationship registers.
Well, I think sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. Certainly the chemistry registers, whether it is a consummated relationship or not. I think if there is chemistry between two people, you feel it. I think that Bogey and myself in To Have and Have Not, I think having fallen in love with one another, finally, I think, first of all, it was great for me because it gave him, he wanted me to be good in it, so he made it much easier for me to play the scenes. The feeling was so strong that, you know, originally in To Have and Have Not, his character was supposed to have a little flirtation with the other woman. And once Hawks saw the rushes of the scenes that Bogey and I had played, Bogey said to him, nobody is ever going to accept or believe that he would go off with anybody else for a second. And it was true.
Lauren Bacall is my guest, and she has a new memoir called Now. When you and Bogart decided to get married, you write that he said to you that he wanted to marry you, but only if you were willing to give up going on location for a film, because he didn't want you both going off in different directions.
Right.
How do you feel about that in retrospect?
Well, I recognize the fact completely that separation does not breed a happy marriage. I think you must be together. I mean, the reason you get married is to be together, not to be separated. And I think particularly in my profession, but in any profession, I think if you each go off in opposite directions, sooner or later, you're just going, one of you is going to go off and not come back. And I think that's natural. You know, and I agreed to his terms.
But you wanted so much to be an actress.
Right.
And this cut down on the roles that you could take.
Yes, oh, absolutely. And I never even got the offers, because I was thought of as Bogey's wife, and then I would just go with him on location, which I did. And we were never separated. We were separated once only for a very short time.
Well, you know, I was thinking how and what frustrating it must have been when he was making African Queen with Katharine Hepburn. You were there in Africa with them, kind of suffering through through all of the problems they had to suffer through. But I mean, you were there as the wife. And
I was there as the wife. I was
not
in charge
as the star.
Of lunch. No, right.
So
no, but you know,
feel?
I had a lot of frustrations mm-hmm. about my career.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, times where I felt I should have been considered for a part that I wasn't considered for. Bogey had decided early on and told me from the very beginning that he would never interfere with my career, that whatever I did professionally, I would do only with myself and my agent. If I wanted his advice, I could ask him, but that he would never step in, and he never did. And sometimes I thought, well, he ought to step in. I mean, once in a while, I should be in a movie with him that one of the parts is... But whatever his decision was, he was correct, because he'd had enough experience to know what worked and what didn't work. And I was very frustrated at times, but I still believe, and I even believed then, that even throughout my frustration, that the choice I made was the right one. Obviously, in view of what happened, it most certainly was the right one. And I'm really happy that I made that choice.
Because your life together
was
short.
Well, because he had a life. He had a life that he never thought he would have. And it was very short. But imagine if I'd gone off somewhere. Well, I mean, he wouldn't have stood for it anyway, so.
After his death, how did that change for you the life you wanted for yourself professionally?
Well, unfortunately, it didn't change very much, because, you know, when people get in the habit of not seeing you very much on screen, that habit kind of carries over. And I played in a movie that was very mediocre.
Which movie?
What was it called? I forgot. With Robert Stack, about the little girl with the horse and the Gift of Love. Wasn't very good. It was a remake, and it wasn't a good remake. And then I went to Europe to be in a movie in England and India, which, of course, I loved. And that movie was quite a good movie. But my career never, you see, then I had to leave California. There was no life for me there. And so my career then shifted to the stage. Then, of course, they don't think about you at all in movies.
Right, because you're outside.
Oh, no. Oh, she wants to be in the theater. Oh, who cares? We're on to the next.
So what did you do to make it clear that you wanted back in?
Well, I just think if you just keep hang in there, you know, and just keep working in one medium or another, I have still not gotten my choice of the best roles in the world. There are still friends that don't think of me for parts because we're friends. Well, I mean, that's life. That's the biz.
In your first film, smoking was such an important part of the role.
Oh, right? I know, it was so dramatic, too.
Oh, yes.
So effective.
Oh, absolutely.
And romantic.
And then your husband, Humphrey Bogart, died of lung cancer.
That's right.
And you continued to smoke, I think, till 1986.
Tell me about it. No, well, I mean, because you just don't believe that it's going to happen, you know. And hopefully it won't.
Was smoking off screen dramatic in any way for you?
Oh,
like
absolutely.
It was on screen?
Oh, absolutely. Because if there was a pause, you know, in a conversation with anyone, you could always light a cigarette. Or if a man lit a cigarette for you, you could look up. I mean, it's the most dramatic thing in the world because it's intimate, it's suggestive, it's... And that's one of the problems with giving it up is that it's very useful. It's a useful tool.
I consider stopping smoking one of the most difficult things I ever did, but I'm thinking, it must have been even harder for you because you had it as a dramatic prop in a way that it never would have worked for me.
No, but so you stopped and you didn't. I finally stopped and I gained 20 pounds and I've been unable to lose them.
Oh, I wouldn't have noticed.
Yeah, well, because, you know, your metabolism changes. Everything changes.
So did you miss the drama of it when you stopped?
Oh, yes. And then, I mean, I haven't had a cigarette in 8.5 years now, which is very good. And for 8 years before then, I was stopping and stopped intermittently about 8 times. But the fact is that when I was in Paris this year for Prêt-à-Porter...
Oh, you can't not smoke
I was
in
sitting
Paris.
In the cafe... I tell you how I resisted that, I will never know.
Yeah.
Because more than once I thought, boy, here I am sitting here with this cup of coffee and friends. A few people are lighting up. What if I just had one? And then I get the urge again. And the only thing I can say about it is that once you've broken your pattern, what saved me was that I just stopped thinking about it because I hadn't done it in so long.
Lauren Bacall, her new book is called Now. This is Fresh Air. Movies are part of our collective memory, something we all share. That's one of the reasons we love bringing you interviews with actors and filmmakers. Public radio has also become something that many Americans share. It's a place we can turn to for news and for some entertainment. And the things we discover, we can talk about with friends and family who have listened too. This week, public radio listeners across the United States are offering their financial assistance to keep their stations going. Your station needs your support. Here's how to call with a pledge. The recent film Backbeat, which is now on video, told the story of Stu Sutcliffe, who played bass with the Beatles before they made it big. He died at the age of 21. A rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, says that if Stu Sutcliffe had lived, the musician and painter might have become a sort of artistic director of the band.
Is a small town that over the years has been engulfed by Liverpool's sprawl, which is to say that unless you're paying attention, you don't know when you're out of one and in the other. In this respect, it's like Woolton, where John Lennon grew up, and, like Woolton, Highton has a Beatles landmark. Unlike Woolton, though, it's not on the official tour, because in Highton Cemetery lies the body of the forgotten Beatle, Stu Sutcliffe. Stu Sutcliffe was born in 1940, just 4 months before John Lennon, and the two men met at Liverpool Art College. It was only natural. Sutcliffe was very much the beatnik, and unlike most of his fellow students, was passionately involved with ideas. He was an omnivorous reader and a person with a genuine love for art. He also dressed oddly and had a sort of James Dean aura about him, and if he hadn't been such a brilliant painter, his friends remember, he would have been expelled. He and John soon became inseparable, and when one of Stu's paintings sold for £65, he ran out and bought a bass so he could join John's group. As you can hear, if indeed that's Stu on that 1961 instrumental Cry for a Shadow, his bass playing was rough but serviceable, and he probably learned all he knew from John, who more or less idolized him. But he was good enough to stick with the band when they got their big break and went to Hamburg in 1960. There, they shared the stage at the Kaiserkeller with another Liverpool group, Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, playing lots of foot-stomping music to see which band would send a member through the rotten stage first. Rory won.
Hey, all you women, don't come around.
The Beatles liked Rory's drummer, Richie Starkey, who called himself Ringo Starr, and in fact preferred him to Pete Best, their own drummer, but they were in no shape to lure him away. One day an artist named Klaus Voormann came to the Kaiserkeller to check out the scene and was mesmerized by the Beatles. He dragged his protesting girlfriend, Astrid Kircher, down there a few days later, and she fell in love with Stu Sutcliffe at first sight. She broke up with Klaus, very amicably it seems, and was soon to be found around the Beatles, taking the first photographs of them and fixing their hair in the sort of style the German students wore, a style that soon became the band's trademark. She also whipped up some leather clothes for them to wear on stage, which gave them a distinctive look. Went back and forth between Hamburg and Liverpool, but in 1961 he knew he had to make a choice. Paul McCartney had never liked him and just knew he could play bass better than Stu. Stu wanted to hang out with the Exes, short for existentialists, the crowd Astrid was with, and before long he and Astrid were engaged. He also found out that the Liverpool Art College wouldn't let him back in since he was suspected of stealing an amplifier from them, a theft that was almost certainly Lennon's work. But Eduardo Paolozzi at Hamburg State Art College thought Stu's canvases were brilliant and got him a scholarship. But there was a problem. Stu was getting blinding headaches and had collapsed several times at school. He refused treatment and had periods when all went well. As April 1962 rolled around, he was looking forward to the Beatles' return to play the Star Club on the 13th. On April 10th, Astrid was working in her darkroom when her mother called to say that Stu was unconscious. She rushed to his side, but he died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, victim of a brain tumor that may have started when some thugs kicked him in the head after an early Beatles gig. Ironically, Stu's mother flew to Germany on the same plane that carried George Harrison and the band's manager, Brian Epstein, but at the airport they got in two separate cars. Hers went to the Kirschers' house in the suburb of Altona to claim her son's body. Theirs went to the Star Club, where they were due to go on in a few hours, the beginning of a road that would lead them to the top.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He now lives in Germany. We're featuring his profiles throughout the week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we look back on the rock group The Band, with its main songwriter, Robbie Robertson. The group was so popular that its last concert before breaking up in 1976 was filmed by Martin Scorsese. Since then, Robbie Robertson has scored movie soundtracks, acted in film, and recorded several solo albums. His new album is a hybrid of rock and Native American music. Robertson is part Mohawk. A conversation with Robbie Robertson coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The American buildup of troops in the Persian Gulf has been slowed down. The Pentagon says Iraqi troops are continuing to move north away from Kuwait. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has this report.
Pentagon spokesman Dennis Box says the shipment of Marines from Camp Pendleton to the Kuwait area is on hold as two of the three Iraqi brigades that threatened Kuwait withdraws north toward their garrisons. He says the situation remains under close watch because remnants of a third brigade are still at a railhead in the south, but
the indications, by and large, are positive that they are, in fact, moving out of that region.
He said America has fewer than 8,000 troops in the area, and he indicated the number will not approach the 33,000 once set as a likely top figure. He said the operation will probably cost about $500 million. Pi Chamberlain, Washington.
There are conflicting reports out of Russia as to whether Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin has resigned. A report by a radio station says the premier has stepped down due to health concerns, but a spokesman for Russian President Boris Yeltsin says the report is false. The official Yeltsin statement says the report does not correspond with reality. Dallas authorities report a woman was killed today in an attempted escape and shootout. The victim was apparently trying to help her husband flee jail. Police say it happened this morning during a prisoner transfer in a parking area. The woman apparently appeared with a gun and traded gunshots with a deputy. The woman died and the deputy was wounded. The prisoner was wounded too. He escaped briefly but was recaptured a block away. Panamanian authorities have arrested two suspects connected with an alleged terrorist bombing of a commuter plane last July. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
Panamanian investigators have arrested two Arab citizens on charges that they participated in a terrorist bombing of a local commuter aircraft. The explosion, which took place 3 months ago, killed all 21 persons aboard, including 12 Jewish businessmen. The bombing occurred one day after an explosion destroyed the Jewish Mutual Aid Society building in Argentina. According to a Panamanian government spokesman, the two suspects were linked to pro-Iranian radical groups headquartered in Lebanon's Bekaa Valley that claim responsibility for both bombings. As part of the investigation, the FBI has been cooperating with the Panamanian authorities trying to identify the body of an Arab male that is presumed to be the suicide bomber. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabral in Panama City.
Texas authorities now report seven people have died in heavy flooding in the southeastern part of the state. An eighth person is missing. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 6 points to end the day at 3,917. Declining issues led advances by a 3-2 margin. This is NPR. A federal appeals court has ruled that employer health insurance plans cannot discriminate against workers with AIDS or who are HIV positive. The American Civil Liberties Union says the ruling breaks new ground. The case began when a small business owner filed suit, claiming his insurer lowered his benefit limit in 1990 when he contracted AIDS. The lower court dismissed the suit after the businessman died last year. The lower court had said the insurance company wasn't liable because it wasn't the businessman's employer, but the appeals court has overturned the decision. Cable operators could soon be allowed to charge viewers an unregulated fee when they add cable channels. The Federal Communications Commission could adopt a new plan letting cable systems make the change as early as this week. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Cable operators say existing regulations discourage them from adding new channels. They say the plan now being considered by the FCC would give them a financial incentive to provide additional services. The new plan would not change prices for regulated channels cable subscribers currently receive. Under the plan, subscribers would buy additional channels only if they want them. Cable operators won't be allowed to add the new channels to existing tiers of service, but would have to group them together in a new package to sell to subscribers. The channels could not be anything previously carried on the system. An FCC attorney says the commission has gotten a lot of flack about the potential of rates going up and people getting stuff they don't want. He says the new plan would control that. The FCC could vote to adopt the new proposal this week. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Defense Secretary William Perry is calling on China to lead the way in restraining arms in Asia. He's in Beijing meeting with Chinese leaders. He cites tension in Korea, border disputes, and friction between India and Pakistan as signs that Asian stability could end abruptly. Perry suggests that China stop selling arms to its neighbors. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're about to look back on the history of one of the most celebrated bands of the 60s and 70s. The band was simply called The Band. It got that name when it backed up Bob Dylan. My guest was the band's chief songwriter, Robbie Robertson. This is one of his best-known songs.
Just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said.
A new box set of the band's recordings is coming out next month on Capitol Records. Robbie Robertson has had a solo career since the band split up in 1976. His latest album is a hybrid of rock and Native American music. Robertson is part Mohawk and spent summers with his mother's family on the Six Nations Reservation in Canada. He spent the rest of the year in Toronto. The songs on his new album, Music for the Native Americans, were written for this month's TV series, The Native Americans, on TBS. Here's one of the songs.
I think I'll go on back to Shenandoah. She said that she'd meet me by the fork in the road. I jump start my one-eyed foot. For the power, I fall on the red path that leads to you. I give my love.
Robbie Robertson and the Red Road Ensemble. Robertson left home at the age of 16 to go on the road with the group Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks. One of the members was Levon Helm, who later co-founded the band with Robertson. Levon Helm was from the Mississippi Delta. Robertson told me what it was like the first time he traveled south to the Delta to play with Hawkins and Helms.
First of all, the idea of going from Toronto down to this place, I thought I was going to where the source of all of this music came from. So I was very excited about this, and I was incredibly impressed with just the way of life, the people, how musical everything was. I understood how come there was so much music in this area once I got there, and the names of all the places and everything. Oh, it just worked for me like mad.
You know, later with the band, you started writing very southern sounding and very lyrically southern songs, you know, like The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. Did you start to think of yourself as southern? Were you trying to write as if you were southern, or were you trying to capture a southern flavor even though you were from the Great North?
No, what this was, It made such a powerful impression on me at 16 years old, at such an impressionable age. And I took this in, and in some ways it was similar to when I was very young and when I went to Six Nations. When you have the opportunity to walk into these worlds and you don't take them for granted, you're incredibly in awe of these places. And then it was, I don't know how many years later, but from when I first went down there, I wrote these songs probably 7-8 years later.
Well, let's hear The Night That Drove Old Dixie Down. My guest is Robbie Robertson, and this is the band.
Virgil Caine is a name, and I served on the Danville train till Stallman's cavalry came and tore up the tracks again. In the winter of 65, we were hungry, just barely alive. By May the 10th, Richmond had fell. It's a time I remember oh so well. The night they drove old Dixie down, and the bells were ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down, and the people were singing. They went la 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 la.
Robbie Robertson is my guest. And he has a new album, by the way, called Robbie Robertson and the Red Road Ensemble, Music for the Native Americans. So what was the period like after Ronnie Hawkins left the band and it became basically the prototype of the band?
Well, what happened was it was kind of the other way around. The Hawks left Ronnie because there was a certain mold that he was comfortable in. There was, you know, just a club circuit that he wanted to play, and we were all a few years younger than him, and we wanted to more adventure. We didn't want to think that this is the way it was always going to be. So we left him and kind of set out into the world once again. In the first while, it was kind of rough for us, but we managed, and it wasn't too long after we left him, I don't know, maybe a year or something, and we hooked up with Bob Dylan.
What was it like for you in the early days of playing with Dylan when you would often get booed by fans who thought that he should stay a folky?
Well, there was times when I wasn't sure that I disagreed with him, that maybe he should stay a folky, because it was, we got booed all over the United States. We went to Australia, they booed us. All over Europe, they booed us. And we were getting better. When it first started out, it was pretty rough. But it was actually starting to take form and find itself. And but the audience was kind of on a mission. You would come to these concerts more to partake in the ritual of booing than you would really to listen to the music. But it was like we were the bad guys in the situation. And there was a lot of people around saying, listen, you better get rid of these guys. I mean, they're ruining everything. And I have to I have to commend him on just his patience or else his hard-headedness. I'm not sure which, but he stuck by it and he believed in it.
Now, how did the band start establishing its identity nationally as a group separate from Dylan?
Well, after we did this tour, we moved up to Woodstock, and we got this house up there, a place really just to go and do some writing and like a clubhouse kind of place, and where we would just congregate every day. And we went there and we started writing some songs, and Bob would come every day and we would hang out. And it was just kind of a very relaxed music situation. There was just, completely no pressure in what we were doing. And Bob started writing some songs. I started writing some songs. Richard Manuel was doing some writing. And out of this came the Basement Tapes, the infamous Basement Tapes, I guess, that became like one of the first largely bootleg records ever. And And then after that, from these songs, the band recorded its first album, Music from Big Pink.
The band, early on anyways, didn't really perform. It was a very studio-oriented group, and the studio was basically in the basement. Were you tired of performing by then?
Well, we did. I mean, when Music from Big Pink came out, we didn't go out and do concerts with that record because one of the members of the band, Rick Danko, was in a car accident, and he broke his neck, and he was in traction for months, and we couldn't go out. And something happened. There was, all of a sudden, it was like we were like this mysterious group that made records and never showed up. And when we did, they were these people all dressed in black and looking like, you know, Pennsylvania Dutch people or something, as opposed to rock and roll musicians. And so there just became that kind of
aura,
you know, aura around the group. And then after we did our second album, then we went and played. I mean, we played at Woodstock, we played at Watkins Glen, we played at the Isle of Wight. We played our first concert at Winterland in San Francisco and our last concert there when we did The Last Waltz. But we did a lot of tours in between, and maybe we didn't do it as much as some do, but we did do it a lot, and we'd already done it a lot. We'd been on the road for 8 years before we made Music from Big Pink.
When did you think it was time to leave the band, you personally?
Well, when we did The Last Waltz, I thought that we had run the gamut then, and something was telling me in my gut that that there wasn't much more that we were going to be able to get out of this. And rather than it just see it kind of just dribble out or it become, you know, an unpleasant situation, like, because I was seeing a lot of other groups around breaking up, and it was not under the most pleasant terms, and I thought, we got to try to avoid this if we possibly can. So that's when I suggested to the other guys that we bring this thing, hopefully, to kind of a classy finale, and I thought of this idea of doing The Last Waltz, where we can kind of pay homage to a lot of the people that had influenced us and that we had a lot of respect for in music, and I thought something needs to be done here to kind of just, you know, up the grade of this, whatever it is. And that's when I talked to Martin Scorsese about doing it. And
did you know him already?
I had met him when he did Mean Streets, but I didn't know him very well. And so, anyway, when I told him, when I met with him and told him about the project, and I told him what I had in mind, because he was saying, geez, you know, this is not a great time for me. I'm in the middle of doing another movie, and, you know, you've caught me at, you know. So when I told him what I had in mind, he said, what am I going to do? I have to do this, you know. And so he proceeded to figure out a way to do it, and we did it on Thanksgiving up in Winterland. And what he did was he made it like he was going to take a little rest, a little Thanksgiving vacation, and we all just slipped up to San Francisco and shot the movie.
When you were ready to leave the band, do you think the rest of the band was ready to disband also?
Well, we, you know, in The Last Waltz, we really weren't talking about disbanding. We were talking about leaving the road behind. It had become to me not a very creative process. It was just kind of a business. And my suggestion was, because I wasn't going to go on the road anymore, but if we wanted that, I was really still, you know, had tremendous respect for the other guys in the band creatively, musically, and I was still interested in experimenting and trying to put the emphasis on trying to make some really good records, and everybody, you know, was kind of understood, you know, what we were talking about. Everybody felt good about this. And after we did The Last Waltz, and in a period of time, because other people had other projects that they wanted to experiment with too. When I brought this up, you know, some of the other guys said, oh, good, because I want to make a solo album anyway. And it wasn't like there was people pulling in the other direction at all. And then after a period of time, for financial reasons or whatever, they came to me and said, well, listen, you know, we realized that this is a bigger part of our lives than what we had realized at the time, and we want to get back together again and go out and perform. And I, you know, I said, I have no objection to that at all. I just can't be part of it.
So you have a new record now, your music for the Native Americans, plus there's a CD box set of music from the band that's about to come out on Capitol Records.
Right.
How do you feel about the music on that box set? What kind of like emotional connection now do you feel toward the music from the days of the band?
Well, I loved going through all this music. There's a lot of things that I haven't heard in years and had kind of forgotten in some ways how we approached some of the material. And when I went through it all again, I really enjoyed it. And I felt, God, these guys, they just kind of reinvented something in rock and roll. The nature of the music, the way everybody played, the style. I felt very, very proud of it. And I'm really glad, because the band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. I thought it was really nice that this band box set was coming out in conjunction with that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Robbie Robertson has a new album called Music for the Native Americans. A box set retrospective of the band's recordings will be released next month. This is Fresh Air. I'm always fascinated by the behind-the-scenes stories that reveal how the records and movies I enjoy were made. Let me share with you a detail about how Fresh Air is broadcast. As you may know, we produce the show in Philadelphia, but the program is carried by public radio stations around the country. Each station that carries the show has to pay a fee, and that fee goes toward our production budget. Right now, your station needs you to call with a pledge so it can raise enough money to continue to broadcast Fresh Air. Nothing on public radio can be taken for granted. Here's how to call with a pledge. Thank you for your support. Writer Lori Moore is best known for her poignant and funny short stories about youngish women searching for love and instead finding themselves in the company of exasperating men who fail to give it to them. In Moore's new novel, the heroine is stuck in a listless marriage and turns for escape to her past. The novel is oddly called Who Will Run the Frog Hospital? Critic Maureen Corrigan says once you've read the novel, the question makes sense.
Lori Moore's novel, Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, opens on a scene that has literary symbol alert written all over it. Our 30-something narrator, an unhappy woman named Berry Carr, is sitting in a Parisian restaurant with her husband, savoring a dish of brains. Berry tells us she's eating the brains to induce some kind of flashback to her childhood. Now, not many writers could risk this dumbing down of Proust's Madeleine symbol, but Lori Moore can because she writes with a lyric intensity that makes cliché images and plots feel young again. Moore's words are many textured things. When Berry is swallowing her memory meal, you feel the spongy circuitry of those brains sliding down her throat. Then, just as smoothly, you're transported with her into a melancholy reverie about the long-ago summer when she had a chaste crush on her best girlfriend. And soon enough, you don't care anymore how Berry retrieved this vivid lost world of her youth, whether it's via cookie or cooked cerebellum. Back in 1972, Berry and her girlfriend, whose name is Silsby, were both 15 and working at a small amusement park in upstate New York called Storyland. Storyland was one of those quaint places, long since squeezed out by Disney, where employees dressed up like fairy tale characters. Silsby, who's blonde and beautiful, works as Cinderella. She wears a sateen evening gown and rides around the park in a papier-mâché pumpkin. Barry works as a cashier, and of course, she's the plain one. Female narrators in fiction almost always are. Think of Jane Eyre or the unnamed governess narrator of The Turn of the Screw. It's like the author gods allow the mousier girls to tell the story as a consolation prize. In addition to being plain, Barry has the added female burden of being undeveloped. She glumly describes her potential breast sites as two wiener-hued puffs. Storyland becomes a kind of enchanted holding pen for the two girls. There they can still play the games of children while they also practice being adults, smoking illicit cigarettes on their breaks, cursing. But when Silsby gets herself a boyfriend and then gets herself into trouble, the spell of extended childhood is broken. To help out her friend, Barry commits petty larceny and is subsequently banished to a military school for wayward youth. Moore's short novel serves as a repository for the teenage girl ephemera of the early 1970s, stuff like Yardley Pado Gloss lipstick, scoop neck leotards, and Desiderata posters. All of this detail helps her precisely capture the delicious, sealed-off atmosphere of girlhood friendships, endless afternoons devoted listening to Joni Mitchell records, and obsessively combing out the hems of blue jeans. No wonder the adult Barry, already exhausted in anticipation of middle age, yearns for her old friend as she sits at that Parisian dinner table across from her husband. Her marriage can't compare to the long-vanished moment of adolescent possibility. As her remembrance of times past trails off, Barry declares, "It is unacceptable, all the stunned and anxious missing a person is asked to endure in life." Moore's novel makes you share Barry's grief over even the most natural of losses.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Who Will Run the Frog Hospital by Laurie Moore. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross, and we're going to end with a song from a new CD by Dawn Upshaw, who will soon be our guest on Fresh Air. The recording features songs by Bernstein, Blitzstein, Sondheim, and Weil. This is Mark Blitzstein's I Wish It So.
I've an unrest inside me. Oh, it's long I have had such an unrest inside me, and it's getting real bad. I'm sleeping at night, and my heart beats so loud that I wake all dizzy and light with a dreaming and feeling this such a thumping inside me that I think I'll go mad. For I wish it so.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Playwright and actor Wally Shawn and theater director Andre Gregory turned their conversations into art in their film My Dinner with Andre. On the next Fresh Air, we bring them together for more conversation. They're both in the new film, Vanya on 42nd Street. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.